Seja mais saudável.
So here's some background. I've actually been working on not a lot other than KD bindings for about 5 years now. It's essentially mad. The reason was in the UK there was this tax law that came in that banned contractors from investing in their own companies. If you're a free software developer, one way to fund your work is to do, say, 6 months contracting in order to fund 6 months of your own developments. And this new tax law made that very hard. So I thought this was my last chance to try and do something of my own, get a portfolio of my own software going, which is what I've done really. This second point about my initial programming experience. I think that the first programming language you use influences how you think about programming. So because I started with a Lisp-like language, which is really what Ruby is now, to me, Ruby just feels like going back 30 years to where I started, which is great. I started programming with Bob 11 on a teletype paper. But it was an interactive environment. It was Unix, and you were interacting with it. So you didn't punch cards in advance like other people did with, say, Fortran. You made up the program as you went along, interactively. And that's exactly how you develop with Ruby now, using a tool called the Interactive Ruby Shell. So that's a different mindset to the way, say, C++ programmers think. They like to design the grand scheme in advance and think very carefully about things, and then they'll gradually implement parts of it all at once. They'll type in, say, 1,000 lines of code, and then they'll compile it. But what they don't do is interactively type 2 or 3 lines, try things out, prototype. It's just a different mindset. So to me, it would be great to get back to that interactive approach. And I think the combination of Ruby and KDE is great. So I'll try and explain why. So many people think they've got the right idea about language bindings, but I think there are a lot of misconceptions. So misconception one is that the C API such as GNOME is very easy to write bindings for. But I disagree, because in C you've got much less type information. C++ is really much more complete, which makes it possible to automatically generate bindings. If you've got a C API, what you tend to have to do is to write long-winded interfaces in either XML or Lisp dialect for GNOME, and then you manually update these interfaces whenever the underlying C API changes. So I believe that the Mono GTK Sharp bindings require 2 or 3 people work full-time to work on them, which is quite labor intensive. And then the second misconception here is that if you describe your API in Corba, such as the Bonobo API, it will automatically work with every language without you having to do anything. Well, I think after a while people realise that that was not the case, and actually the hardest part of GNOME to wrap is the Bonobo side. And then a third misconception, which is the current one that's running, is that wrap your Mono API in C#, and then you get Python and Ruby and all these other languages for free. Well, actually no, because all you've got currently is an alpha version of Python. You can use BASIC, but then it's not a very suitable API for BASIC programmers. The sort of API C# programmer will like is more oriented towards systems programming. To use BASIC, you actually want wanted something much, much simpler. So in practice, you actually design separate class hierarchies for basic programmers. It just doesn't actually work. And then a fourth misconception. Language bindings always need lots of manual attention. Well, not if you use C++ for your API, just because it's got such a lot of type information. It's really an interface definition language in itself. So that means that you can actually automatically generate bindings. It's more like compiling. So for instance, nobody complains that the mock effectively generates limited bindings for slots and symbols, but nobody expects people to manually correct the output of the mock. But that's because the mock can just parse the C++ header, and there's sufficient type information that it gets it right 100% of the time. And so all language bindings are a superset of what the mock does. So if we start to think of language bindings as mock on steroids, as opposed to this labour-intensive image that they've got now, where 10 people work away for 5 years and finally get something working, that's not how it should be. And then the final misconception, the more language bindings the better, even if they're half finished. Well, I don't think so. GTK has lots of weird language bindings, but they're generally for GTK1. They've probably started and never quite finished. You need a lot of other things other than just the bindings. You need a development environment, an IDE to go with it. You need documentation. You need a sufficient number of people using the bindings such that a community forms so they can help each other. So I think one thing that the Mono project have got right with the GTK Sharp bindings is they've seen it's got to be a complete development platform. They're doing Mono development, they're doing the documentation. You know, it may be two or three people working full time on C Sharp bindings, but it's something solid that people can rely on. So I think out of what I've seen of Gnome, that the GTK Sharp development environment looks the most promising to me personally. So this is what I personally discovered, or how I think about the bindings. Because the bindings I maintain are automatically generated from the headers. Once I get that side of it working, you can build, say, the current Ruby project from KD3.1 headers right through to KD3.4. Because they're automatically generated, whatever headers, whatever classes are there, are just what goes into the smoke runtime, this language-independent auto-generated library. So it just means that once you've got it all working, to generate the Ruby bindings, you go into KD bindings, smoke KDE type, make clean, make woof, and it generates I counted the number of lines of code generated automatically last night, and it was 580,000 lines of code, which all compiles without error. 1,000 classes, 30,000 methods, all automatically generated. And then you need, documentation. So an important thing to be able to do is to extract the doc comments from the C++ headers and convert them into the target bindings language. So I do that for Java now. Java bindings come out with Java docstyle comments and code snippets translated from C++ to Java. So one thing to be done for the Ruby bindings is to have RDoc format comments extracted from the C++ market. So one issue for KD4 might be, can we improve the markup that people put into the doc comments to make them more language independent? Maybe rather than try and auto-convert the code snippets, maybe have a markup to say this is a code snippet for C++, this is one for Java, this is one for Ruby, and then they could be extracted in some way. And then books, books are really that's what KDE needs in general. I've got a couple of books about KDE too, and I really like to read through to get an overall picture of the API. At the moment with KDE 3, there are no current books, to my knowledge. And it's actually quite hard to know where to start. You can search for tutorials online, and there are things here and there, but I personally miss having a nice complete guide to the KDE API and that takes you through the tutorials and so on. So we need that for C++ and for the binding languages too. You've got to have enough people using the bindings so that it's not just the developer, the original developer of the bindings who can give advice to people. You need to get the community going where they all help each other, and then it can start to take off. Until you get to that stage, you can't really get it bootstrapped. And finally, without some sort of IDE, it's not much use. You have to have an environment with, say, a RAD tool like Qt Designer, which can generate Ruby or Java code, plus a suitable debugger in KDevelop or Eric 3. The things you'd expect these days in a RAD tool. It's no use just expecting people to work from the command line, really. So these are the current active projects. The longest running, most mature project is PyKDE. It's got a lot of users, an active mailing list, there's a commercial version. I think they set the gold standard or whatever for success in bindings. They're probably out of any bindings project on any toolkit. I think they're probably the most mature and the most successful. Then there's PerlQt and PerlKDE, which is a sister project of the Ruby bindings. They use the same Snoke library, so they're very technically innovative, as is the Ruby one, and complete, and they have got an active user community. Then Qt Java. I really thought if I developed a better toolkit with a better API than Swing, it was a virtual certainty that I would be running on every device in the world and would have single-handedly knocked Sun off the top spot in Java toolkits. But, it's not that simple. SWT came along, and I really think that Java programmers like to have they don't like diversity. I think free software people, we like lots of choice, and we like playing around with things, but I don't think the Java world works like that. They like to have the big company IBM or Sun saying this is the way to go ahead with your GUI toolkits. So no matter how technically good some small third-party Java toolkit is, it's the same problem with Java GNOME. I don't think as many applications have been developed with that. Not compared with GTK Sharp. But that's not really the technical differences between GTK Sharp and Java GNOME. It's more that Novell are right behind GTK Sharp. There's no substitute for a big company giving this stuff a push. Then there's Qt Ruby and Corundum, which it seems to be taking off. I'm quite hopeful that with the Qt 4 version of Qt Ruby running on Windows, it might get really popular, so I'm quite looking forward to seeing what happens about that. And then KDS Embed, which isn't quite in the same category as these other bindings, but might be in the future, so it's more intended for lightweight scripting rather than RAD, but it is an actively maintained project. So here are the dead ones. Sharp. Well, I think everyone would think that it would be nice to have a C-sharp API for Qt and KDE, so it's a great shame that that one died. It's certainly technically possible. They did an initial version, but never seemed to quite get through and produce a second version. I don't know whether it's technical issues or social issues. They didn't seem to get along very well, the Qt-sharp team. And Qt Sharp, depending on Qt C, which I developed, as did the Objective C Qt Objective-C bindings. So because the Qt Sharp people couldn't update their Qt Sharp API in line with the Qt-C API, it meant that I couldn't update the Objective-C bindings either. So all three went down together. Sad. So start talking about the various technical issues involved in producing a binding. So the first thing you have to do is parse the API, or you parse interface files which are derived from your target API. So the first most common approach is you don't parse the headers directly, you write interface definitions manually. So that's the approach used by SIP, which produces PyQt and PyKDE. SWE, which is used a lot, works quite well on a small scale, but I don't think it scales up very well. And then the known bindings require a lot of maintenance. They're either interfaces in XML or Lisp dialect. I think that, it's all pretty manual as far as I can see, so very tedious to work on. So a better approach is to parse the headers directly, which is what I've done with this Calyptus tool. I was working on adapting KDoc, which is the equivalent of DoxyGen, adapting it to be able to document Objective-C APIs. So I got familiar with how it worked. And then when I came to start working on the Objective-C bindings, I thought, well, this KDoc parses all the C++ headers. It builds up these nice abstract syntax trees, which you can walk. And KDoc actually generates HTML documentation. I thought if it can generate HTML, well, maybe it can generate the target bindings API. And in fact, it worked very well. I'm still using that today. But it's written in Perl, and I think Perl's a bit ugly, and it'd be nice to have some slightly cleaner parser. It's a bit hacky. It does parse all the headers, but it's not very elegant. So maybe in the future for KDE4, we're developing a C++ parser for KDevelop4 for code completion and for the class browser. So I think that parser might be a good candidate to use for generating bindings. It produces an abstract syntax tree, and then the idea is you've got various visitor classes that you can write. So you might have one visitor class which will do the class browser parsing, and another which will do code completion. So you could have a different sort of visitor to do the large scale refactoring needed to generate bindings. So I need to look into that. And then another approach is you can use GCC with an option to dump out an XML version of the compiled code, and then parse that XML and in turn generate your bindings. So that means you're using a very high quality parser in the GCC compiler. But the downside is it only works with GCC, so I'm not so sure about that. And finally, another approach is to use DoxyGen, which has an option to generate XML, and then that XML is quite similar to the translation done from GCC, so you can walk around the DOM tree generating the stuff. So having managed to generate the bindings, the next issue you have to think about is the runtime stuff. You have to keep track when you create a new Java instance. You have to know which underlying C++ instance it corresponds to. So in Java there's a private instance variable, a long, which is just a pointer to the C++ instance. Ruby has an actual built-in facility called Data Wrap Struct, which is designed for hiding C++ structs for that very purpose. And I think Python and Perl have something similar too. So then having mapped from C++ to the bindings language both ways, another thing you have to watch is garbage collection. Because say Ruby doesn't know about an instance anymore, it doesn't mean it's valid to be garbage collected. So in order to prevent things being wrongly garbage collected, you have to walk the queue object tree at sweep intervals and go around marking the queue object tree, all the instances still being in use. So that's quite an issue you have to think about, and it's different for every language. Ruby has mark and sweep garbage collection, Java and Perl have, and Python have reference counting. So whereas I walk around with Ruby's marking, you have to implement a reference count in these other languages. For C++, if you want to override virtual methods, the only way you can do it is by subclassing, say, QWidget with a bindings version of it. And then for each virtual method, you have to call the scripting language and say, have you overridden this method? If not, I'll call the original C++ one, else I'll call you. So the only way you can do that is by having a subclass for each class in the target API. And another reason you need these bridge classes is you can't normally call a protected C++ method from outside the class. And you actually need to be able to do that if you want to call protected methods from your bindings language. Then you've got problems like multiple inheritance. Most languages don't support multiple inheritance. Java has single inheritance with interfaces. For instance, in the Qt toolkit, there's Q-range control, and then Q-widget, and then something like Q-slider inherits from both. So in that case, you make the Q-range control interface, and then the proper inheritance is from Q-object. So what that means is you've actually got to copy the implementations of all the methods from Q range control into the body of Q slider. You've got to do that automatically. And making sure they haven't already been implemented in Q slider. So that's a sort of major transformation you have to make. It can be done automatically. But you have to manually tell or set up a description file which tells you should it be Q range control or Q object, because there's no way you can tell automatically. I think it's obvious to a human which way around it should be, but I don't think any tool could automatically tell, really. And I've already talked about documentation, so it's very useful if you can automatically convert the doc comments. Another issue is, really in Java, you don't want to see Q strings. You expect to see Java strings in your API. Similarly with Ruby, you want Ruby strings, and you don't want shorts and all these weird number types that you've got in C++ in your bindings language. So although you map the higher level classes one for one, as it gets lower level, it makes more and more sense to use the bindings languages versions of these primitive types. You couldn't really call a time and date class a primitive type, but in the Java bindings I use calendar and then the Java date class. So it seemed to make sense, but I don't in Ruby, so that's a marginal case. I'm not sure which is best there, but that's a design decision you have to make anyway. With Qt Designer, it is language independent, but it actually only comes with a .ui to C++ compiler, the UIC. So there are various bindings versions of the UIC. There's the PyUIC, RBUIC for Ruby, It's a Java one, a Perl one, I think. And they'll all have to be written for Q4, rewritten for Q4, unfortunately. And then slots and signals have to be implemented in the bindings language and look something similar to the original version of slots and signals. So there are different ways of implementing slots and signals which have advantages and disadvantages. In Ruby, I generate QMeasure objects at runtime, which is a different approach to the one used by PyQt, which has a sort of general purpose proxy class, which is always used no matter what your target class is for handling slots and signals. So instead of connecting the real class to the producer of the signal, you connect the PyQt proxy class, which in turn talks to the PyQt target class. Whereas in Ruby, it goes straight from the target class to the C++ class producing the signal. So in some bindings, you have this proxy within direction, and some you don't. And the approaches have got different advantages and disadvantages. Well, yes, so I just mentioned in Ruby, I create measure objects on the fly, which is fun. In fact, in one of the great things about Q4 is the measure object design is quite a bit cleaner than Q3 one, and it's actually come out very tidy that code. C++ has many more types than almost any other language. It's got masses of numeric types. It's got unsigned shorts, signed shorts, long longs. There's loads and loads of them, and it's got many different sorts of string types. So you have to be careful if your bindings language only has one sort of string, but there are two original methods in the C++ API which were overloaded. You only want to generate one of those methods in the target class. You have to make sure you choose QString over, say, QCString, because it's a more useful one. Even if the bindings language has got automatic garbage collection, and most of the time that works just fine with Q, but occasionally you do have to actually force a C++ delete. Say you want to remove an entry from QList view. The best way to do that is to actually delete the QList item. So you need, even with automatic garbage collection, I call them dispose and isDispose methods to, I've got those names from SWT, to force a deletion of the underlying C++ instance of garbage collection. An instance ownership is about the issue of was the C++ instance created in the C++ world, or was it created in your bindings language? Because if the bindings language created it, then at garbage collection it should delete C++ instance. But if the instance was created over in C++, then C++ is responsible. So you have to have a flag or some means of telling how did this C++ instance come to be. If there's an API call like parent in QObject, which is type QObject star, and say that parent wasn't created in the bindings language, how do you know what real class it is? Because it might be a push button, it might be a QWidget. Well, fortunately, QObject has a method called class name, which allows you to introspect there. So what you do is you get the C++ instance returned by parent, use class name to get the real class name, and then you use that to create the Ruby class. So that's for QObjects. And there are various other sorts of runtime type information in the Q classes, like Q few canvas items of a field called RTTI. So you have to go on this number which tells you which sort of key canvas item to instantiate. So you have to write code anyway to do your best to resolve more accurately than the original API tells you which sort of class to instantiate. Then another typical issue is before 1.5, the 1.5 version of Java, you couldn't have covariant return types. If some superclass returns, say, a QPush button, and then in KDE, a subclass of that has the same method which returns a KPush button, well, we can do that in C++, but you can't do that in Java, it'll give you a compile error. So you have to actually rename the method there for the KDE one, say, maybe put a K in front of it or whatever. So that's a little gotcha. Here's an example of what documentation auto-generation looks like. So this is some Doxygen comments from kapplication.h. You can see case of action with some double colons, which is C++-y. And here's the Java one. So the double colons have been replaced with a dot. We've got at short, which is a Java doc tag. And the code snippet is now automatically translated into the Java version of the API. So by and large, that works pretty much as is, but I think for KD4 it would be nice to have some extra annotation for the more complicated code snippets. Something simple like a one-line thing like that you get right automatically, but there are some code snippets of about 15 or 20 lines long. Right, so this is some preparatory explanation for how the smoke library works. There are two different sorts of object-oriented programming. The most commonly known one is functional style, where in C++ you call a C++ member and you think of it like a function call. Whereas if you ask a small talk program, how do they think about calling, making a method called invocation, they'll say, we see it like sending a message to an object. So it's not just a different way of thinking about things. Those two languages actually work very differently underneath. And Ruby is an example of the dynamic style message passing. So here's a little snippet of Ruby here. Ruby has a catch-all method called method missing. And there's something similar in Perl called autoload. So these languages don't have an implementation of a method. They'll call this default method, which is normally an error. It's normally a problem. But it didn't necessarily be an error. So this code snippet is giving an example of tracking a method call with method missing. And then that if statement there, if Tom, Nick and Harry includes the method name that you just called, so if it's one of Tom, Nick and Harry, then I'll put out a message saying, hello Tom, hello Harry. Otherwise, by default, call the super version of method missing, which is an error. So if we run that code, we get, greet a Tom is okay, so we get hello Tom, because Tom was in that that list of methods, in method missing, but Sue wasn't. If we added Sue to the array, we wouldn't get an error. So we get method missing, undefined method Sue from the greeter class. So if we weren't using method missing, this is what the conventional, this is what it would look like in C++ to do the same thing. You've no concept of a catch-all method. So the only reason Spanish Greeter responds to Tom, Dick and Harry is because there are Tom, Dick and Harry methods there. So that's similar to what the situation you've got in C++. You just couldn't do that methodistic stuff. So there's no sue method, so the Spanish greeter fails in exactly the same way. So the interesting thing about that is, although the first greeter was implemented using method missing, unless you could actually see that code, you can't tell without looking inside the object that the behavior is identical. You get the same error message, sue is missing, for two entirely different reasons. So that's the underlying principle of how the smoke library works. It's like diverting rails where you've got a point switch. So the train's coming along and then the points are switched and it goes on a different track. So because we've got this message passing you, the messages come along like trains and they get switched into the method missing method and then thence on to make C++ calls with the smoke library. So it's a way you can funnel 30,000 method calls in the Qt and KDE APIs into a single method call, which no other bindings implementation does. And that actually allows you a lot of flexibility, which you couldn't do in any other implementation. So that was the basis of how this smoke library works. Smoke stands for Scripting Meta Object Compiler Engine. So really it's a, like a mock thing, but it's a turbo mock. Whereas mock with Qt just does the slots and signals. Smoke is the entire API. We have introspection for the entire API, every method, every enum, every class. Automatically generated. So this guy Ashley Winters, who usually does Perl bindings, his third Perl binding. So he's probably the most experienced bindings writer that there is. He came up with this idea, and I personally didn't think it was going to work, and well, it does. So Ashley really should get more recognition. I think the main problem is it's very hard to explain how smoke works, which is why I'm trying to do it now. I'll maybe ask questions if I haven't done it very clearly. So what smoke does is that it means that all 30,000 calls go through a single method missing call in Ruby or an autoload call. And then you've got the issue of overloading methods. So you're in a method missing and you know foobar's being called. Let's say the Qt API has a foobar which expects an int and it has a foobar which expects a string. You have to know which one, which real C++ method to call. Just because you know the name foobar doesn't mean you know the right one. So I have to say, is the first arg a Ruby string? If so, I'll call the C++ foobar expecting a Q string. Otherwise, if it's a Ruby int in the first arg, I'll call one expecting an int. And that actually gets quite complicated. Because if you've got a nil type in the middle of five args, how do you know whether that nil in the middle is supposed to be a string or an int if they're two different overloaded options? So you have to evaluate the match, really, and you take the best match. And in fact, that's what C++ does, but it does it at compile time. Most people doesn't occur to them that there is matching going on, because it's, to humans, it's pretty obvious normally if the C++ API is well designed which method's going to get called. But actually the implementers of the C++ compiler have to do a lot of work to do this overloaded method resolution at compile time. And then the worst possible sort of overloading is when two methods only differ on the type of the enum passed. There aren't any instances of this in the Qt library, but there are a couple in KDE which technically the Ruby bindings cope with that, but I really don't think it's a good idea. I think for KD4, it'd be nice to argue that we shouldn't do that, and because for scripting languages, enums are just numbers by and large. It's really unreasonable for a scripting language to expect to know the C++ type of an enum number passed. Right, so because every single method call is routed by this kind of switch mechanism into method missing, what that means is you've got one point where you can rename a method call, say. So because Ruby programmers, some of them like their method names to be in all lowercase with underscores, whereas others, like camel case names, such as we've got in the original C++ API, because the method call goes to one place, I can actually give programmers the option of having underscores in their method names in three lines of Ruby code. Say you had a conventional bindings implementation, you'd have to have a little condition in every single method call saying, if it's set underscore widget, do this, else if it's set uppercase W widget, do that. There's no way you can do it in three lines, so we can remap the method names on the fly. So in Ruby, people much prefer to say clicked question mark as opposed to is clicked, open bracket, close bracket. They prefer nil question mark to do a null test. Or you can actually call methods, you can give method names in Ruby a name that ends in equals. And then when you call it, it looks like an assignment. So that thing foobar equals item, it looks as though foobar is an instance variable. But what you're doing there is a method call called set foobar and passing it item. So it's exactly the same as that set foobar C++ style call. And it produces some very clean looking code, so I think that's quite a nice feature. And then the class names, I've remapped them to be Qt colon for the Qt namespace, and then everything inside is widget. Or say it was Q push button, you've got Qt colon push button, or we've got K push button, so that would be KD colon push button, and that's actually quite useful because you can write code which will run both Qt only and or on KDE just by including a different namespace there. Either say include Qt or include KDE, and your same code will just have push button in it. So as long as K push button has all the same method calls as Q push button, makes it much easier to write code that can take advantage of KDE if it's there. Otherwise, it'll just be Qt only. Because Smoke allows you to introspect the entire API, there's this command line tool here, which is very handy to see which methods have been implemented. So if I want to see all the qsize methods in the Smoke runtime, I just do rbqt api qsize, and out they will come. Although they're in C++ format, so one enhancement for the future is to make it more, come out in the format of your bindings language. But it's still very handy as it stands. And then there's another option, -r, which just looks for a string. So if I want to find all the method calls which have got set height in them in the API, I'll just go -r, set height, and then they're all listed for you. So I mentioned earlier that you need a way of mapping, given a C++ instance, which is its corresponding Ruby instance, and then given a Ruby instance, which is its corresponding C++ one. Inside the Ruby instance, we don't just store a pointer to the C++ instance, we have this struct with various upfields of other information in there. So allocated tells you did the C++ world create this object in the first place, or if yeah, or true. If it's true, then it means that Ruby has created this instance by somebody saying Qt push button dot new some Ruby code, and then the smoke star pointer there is a pointer to the smoke library where all the lookup tables are. The integer class ID smoke maps all the class names onto numbers currently. So if there are 1,000 classes, it goes from 1 to 1,000. So and then there are lookup functions in the smoke API which allow you to get a class name given a class number. So that's quite useful. And then the void star is just a pointer to the C++ instance. So this is so here's how you look up a method in the smoke runtime. What you have to do is first you look at the argument types, and then primitive types. You add a dollar for each primitive type. You add a dollar onto the method name, and then the so if you look at Qt method call there, it's got $2. That's because the target method call has an enum first, followed by an int. They're two primitive types. And then a pointer. Well, that's a question mark. So for each argument, you add one of these three characters. If it was a class, like a Q widget, you'd add a hash character. So what this does is, if you can get away with finding a single, even if the method's overloaded, that might be sufficient to resolve the method overloading, because a full overloaded method resolution match is quite expensive, so it's handy if you can speed that up. So this, Ashley Winters calls it method name munging. So that's the first step you have to do to call a smoke method. You create a munged name. And then there's this smoke find method, which gives you an entry point for that particular munged name. And if you get a result back which is greater than zero, it means there's only one match. So that's great. You've resolved your overloading just by munging the name, which is what we've done in this case. There's only one Q metrical in the Q4 API. It's not overloaded. If the test meth greater than zero had returned a value of meth which was negative, it gives you a negative value of the number of methods which are overloaded for that munged name. And then you can step through them doing some more complex, expensive resolution to resolve the overloaded method. So in this case, we're lucky, we've got one method back. So the next step is to obtain a function pointer, which is that fm there. You can obtain a corresponding function pointer for each of the 30,000 methods in the Qt or KDE API, and they all expect three arguments. First, the method to be called, which is it's a number. So there's a big switch statement really inside each class, and that's dispatched off this method number. And then the second two args are but the second arg is the actual the C++ instance. And I is a pointer to an array of void stars. So the smoke library has the concept of a smoke stack, which I define here with the I square brackets 4 call. That's a allocating a stack of four elements. So there's three elements for each of these args passed to the function pointer, plus a zeroth element, which is the return value. QT method call actually returns an int. So if you look at the line below the function pointer call, we're getting the return value back, but QT method call has returned, and then we convert it to Ruby, a Ruby number, and return that to the Ruby environment. So that smokestack avoids star pointers, as it turns out, is very similar indeed to the new QT4 stack of pointers which are passed when you call a signal. So here's what some code generated by the mock for QT4 looks like for a signal call. You see void star A there has three values. So this signal takes two arguments and returns, if it did have a return type, it would be returned in the zeroth element of the void star stack here. So what that means is it's actually worked out, smokers worked out a better match for Q4 than it did for Q3. So it's come out really quite tidy. Ashen Winters originally designed Smoke for dynamic languages like Perl or Ruby, and he was thinking of designing another library called Mirror for static languages like Java or C Sharp. I came up with the idea of if you could use Java proxies. A Java proxy allows you to take the Java interface as an argument call when you create the proxy, and then it's normally used for, say, forwarding a method call to a remote object. So you would use a Java dynamic proxy to allow you to make a local method call look like a remote method call look exactly the same as a local method call, and then it might actually do some RMI and communicate with the server back end. Or that's the normal use for dynamic proxies. But I came up with the idea of using dynamic proxies to map the entire Java API onto a single proxy invoke call. So although we need to generate the proxy interface code in advance, it's not completely dynamic like Ruby. We don't need interfaces in Ruby to use Smoke. You can do it in Java or C#, as long as you can generate all the interfaces, you can interface to the Smoke runtime dynamically, which means normally when you wrap a C++ API for Java, you have to have a JNI call for every single C++ method call. It's really clunky, and it ties you very much to JNI. It makes it very hard. If you wanted to use the alternative way of interfacing with C++ used by GCJ, which is called CNI, which is actually cleaner and more elegant than JNI. The trouble is, if you have to entirely duplicate your bindings code for those two styles of C++ interface, it's very expensive. On the other hand, if we can just go through one proxy invoke, then it makes it easy to do some conditional code, and we can, just in one source file, we can interface with both CNI and JNI and a bit of conditional compilation.
Can you still use reflection on Qt class and use the Smoke in Java? Do you still have to complete list of everything that class contains? But doesn't that work if you use Smoke bind for Java?
Yes, because you've got all the Java code, it's just you don't have to generate the corresponding C++ code.
Right.
So externally, the Java class looks exactly like it did if it was a conventional JNI-based implementation. It's just inside you've got the dynamic proxy stuff going on. So that's great. And it, similarly in C sharp, the P invoke, another misconception is, I should say, that P invoke is really easy to use and much cleaner than JNI. Well, not so. In fact, P invoke is only very suitable for small scale C APIs. It has absolutely no capability to interface to C++. It has no naming convention like JNI has for overloaded methods. If you've got overloaded methods and you're using JNI, you have to come up with this convoluted name wrangling scheme. It's pretty nasty if you don't do it, but don't automatically generate it. It's almost as hard as the C++ name wrangling schemes. It looks pretty ugly, but it does do the trick. If you don't have some conventional name wrangling scheme and pinvoke doesn't, and you're trying to interface to a C++ library, you're a bit stuck. So it's not really true that pinvoke is easy to use. It's only true if you've got a very small C API. Otherwise, it's clunky. So the downside is it's obviously more expensive to make a method call via a proxy as opposed to a direct call. We did some tests with the Java implementation and the Sun one. It was about 50% of the speed. So there's a bit of a trade-off there for the dynamism you get by interfacing with smoke as opposed to more efficient and static way with the one-to-one mapping JNI to C++ method. But I think in practice that wouldn't be noticed because Qt is written in C++ and most of what is going on when you're dealing with an interface, most of what is going on is the C++ code. Really the bindings language is just making some pretty often, unless it's a game, there's very little, there's a proportion of the code that's being executed in the binding side. Nearly everything that's going on functionally is being done in C++. So I've always found that you can't really tell the difference between a bindings language application running as opposed to the original native one. The only thing you tend to notice is it takes a bit longer to start up. So I'm pretty certain that in practice it wouldn't be a big problem, the slowdown using proxies. So thinking about how to improve smoke, the big disadvantage at the moment is that the entire Qt API has to go in one library. So even though you might only use, say, 50 classes in your program, you always have to link against the entire 400 classes in the Qt libraries. So normally, in both PyQt and Qt Ruby, the size of the bindings library is roughly the size of the original library you started with. So for Qt, that's something like 8 meg. So the Qt Ruby size is about 7 meg. So it's a bit, seems a bit of a waste to have to always load all these classes that you never use. So we're thinking one idea is to just have a small kernel of the classes that you always have, like QObject, QApplication, and then load everything else on demand. And then we could get quite fast startup and still have the full API available if we wanted it. Another approach in between the two is to have Qt4 has been split up into sublibraries, so we could have a binding sublibrary corresponding to each of the, say, the core Qt library, the GUI library, and the SQL library. In fact, that's what PyQt does at the moment. It's split up into sublibraries, so that although PyQt libraries are bigger than Smoke because they're only loaded, it only loads the ones you're using. It means that PyQt actually uses slightly less memory than Qt Ruby. So that's something that needs to be thought about. So So the Smoke Library does introspection. So if we thought about how we could improve that, Ashley Winters has suggested if you're going to use Doxygen or take a dump of the GCC translation unit, get XML. Well, why not just stay with the XML, put it inside each of these .so files, the XML definition of the class, and then use XPath to introspect. So if you're looking for a set height method, you use XPath to find the XPath method in the XML. I'm not so sure about that one myself. Another way to do the introspection in the future might be to say, well, if What Smoke is a turbo version of the Qt mock, well, why not just use the exactly the same mechanism that the mock uses? So instead of just stopping at slots and signals, we'll have a Qmock measure object entry for each ordinary method. And in fact, internally, if you look inside the definition of Qmeter object, there is an enum as well as one for signal methods and slot methods. There's another one for vanilla methods. So it's all that infrastructure is already in Qt 4. So I quite like the idea of having every single class being a Q object. So even a Q string would be a Q object. Given a Q string, you can actually mess around with Qt metacast to get the underlying Q object out of your Q string. So I think that's quite neat, that one. So here's some code anyway, which shows some Ruby being dynamic with decot. Well, firstly, here is a decot server in less than 15 lines of Ruby. There's a slot there, my slot, which prints out a greeting on standard output. If you're writing this in C++, it'd probably be we'd have a header file, we'd have a .cpp file. It'd probably be 150 lines. You've got to run a decot preprocessor on it. And then after that, you run a mock preprocessor on it, put a make file. So you can do all that in 15 lines of code, and it looks exactly the same. There's no way anyone using the decot server could tell it was written in Ruby. So for stuff like decot, it's just so much simpler than C++, really. There's a big advantage there. And, similarly, Python has a nice, easy-to-use decot interface. And then I talked about being able to remap method names on the fly with the Smoke Library. The corundum bindings do exactly the same for decot methods. So we have the KDE clipboard, it's called Clipper. So there's a decot method, set clipboard contents, which allows you to change the contents of the clipboard. So because the bindings can remap set methods into more Ruby style theme equals methods. What that means is at the bottom line there, which looks like assigning to a property of Clipper, is actually a set method call, which I think is very nice. It's easier to read, really, I think. There's less clutter there. Finally, we need really good development tools to use with bindings to Qt KDE4. So the PyKDE guys have created templates for each sort of C++ library, dynamically loaded library that you can call, like KParts is actually a dynamically loaded library. So the only way you can actually call one of those from bindings languages, have a top level C and C++ stub, which then starts the bindings interpreter. So to make that easy to use, it really should be in an IDE as a project template, and then you just say, create me a Python K-part project template, or create me a Ruby one, and it'll put this set up this stub for you. And then it's just really easy to write K-parts in a bindings language, or you need to do the same for a plugin API. So we need to work on those templates. And then I've added a really good Ruby debugger to KDevelop, which uses the runtime introspection available, and you actually get a lot more information out in debugging Ruby than you do in C++. It's really very nice. It's a shame I can't. I can show you running on my iBook, and if anyone wants to see it after the talk. Anyway, maybe I'll put it at the front there and give a smaller demo. That's very nice. And then another little known IDE is called Eric 3. I really think it deserves to be better known. Maybe the Python guys know that. But recently the developer, DevDev Offenbach, has added a Ruby debugger. And I've helped him add a facility to be able to invoke the Ruby UIC compiler to convert .ui files to Ruby code. It already includes some feature to do that in the Python project, so it calls the PyUIC .ui compiler. So that's a nice IDE too. It's great to have a choice between KDevelop and Eric 3. So we really need better Python support in KDevelop. That'd be great to have a debugger as good as Eric. Qt Designer itself is really a rad tool, so if you can actually integrate that in your IDE, that's all about it. So we've done that in KDevelop, so it's actually part of the KDevelop UI. It's seamlessly embedded, whereas Eric 3 integrates with Qt Designer by invoking it whenever you want to edit a .ui file. That's still nice to have that integration anyway. I think the Qt 4 version of Qt Designer is really designed to be able to be used as a plugin, so it should be possible for both KDevelop and the future versions of Eric 3 to have it in the same UI rather than as a separate process. Yeah, so that's it. Is there any questions?
Was to give you enough technical info to be able to start a discussion for the meeting we're going to have. So I don't know if you've been blinded by science, was it clear?
We may be a little overwhelmed.
Sorry?
We may be a little overwhelmed.
All right.
Very interesting.
I can just bring my iBook down to the front and we can play around with KDevelop and see what it really looks like. Oh, okay, questions?
Just as someone who's never used Python. Who really has only ever programmed in C++ to KDE, what would be a good example of an example application using Python, just to see how to get started?
I think writing a decomp server it's great for integrating it. Say you want to call a SOAP service, it's a much easier API to call SOAP from Ruby than it is from C++. And you don't need GSOAP and all that stuff.
Are there any programs, where are the programs out there that I should look at that exist for you?
Well, if you look at the KDE Developers Corner site, I've got tutorials and there's a KDE tutorial, so maybe just go through that and you might have some ideas, I don't know. But the sort of things where you need a preprocessor in C++ generally, in Ruby, you don't need that to use SOAP. So I think that's going to be, when KDE just starts needing to constantly make net calls, you know, to the internet, SOAP, XML, RPC, I think that's when dynamic languages like Ruby come into their own. So really, I think that the killer app for the Ruby bindings would be somebody doing a GUI front-end KDE that does very fancy things, you know, calling up Wikipedia and integrating with Google Maps or something like that. I think that's my picture of the sweet spot.
Are there any existing well-known applications that maybe I should know about that are actually already using
there's also a few installed KKD manuals, a couple of really easy to follow examples in there. So yeah, just have a look at it and you'll understand it about that. It's really cleanly written.
There's an LDAP browser in IQ also that's pretty powerful. Fluid Samba administration via LDAP. That's a pretty substantial application and pretty polished to show off what you can do in a C++ and still have to look like Qt application.
Do you mean the UMAR?
Is it UMAR or
yes.
Yeah.
I just wonder why this, when I compare Python Qt versus Python GTK, to be honest, maybe it's more fun to use Python GTK because it's faster, lighter somehow to use it. I use Python binaries for more than 12 years, and using bindings to C is always more fun. C++, it's a little bit, I don't know, you know what I mean?
Not quite. to me, the PyKit API looks clean. I think the Ruby one is cleaner, personally, but whatever.
It's not that.
It's a personal taste.
It's just somehow there are a lot of PyGTK applications, for example, but there are not so many PyQt applications.
Well, you would actually be amazed how much PyQt is used in the real world. I know, for instance, that one Dutch television channel uses PyQt a lot. And PyQt offer has been sponsored by Disney Television because their internal terminal is all PyQt. Years ago, I started looking at some UI toolkits for Python, and I evaluated all of them that existed at the time. I was shocked when I found out that the GTK API was GTK 1. Something times. They actually wanted me to program the scroll bar for a tree view myself. It wasn't in the widget, so I immediately dismissed that toolkit and started working with PyQt, which was very young at the time.
By the way, is the KDE extensions guy in Zoom?
No,
but
I think he was in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah,
I think he's important. No, PyKD extensions guys, Sam Edwards, that's the guy I'm working with. And, if you got a question about that, I might know the answer.
Because I never could compile it. I used it on very.
Actually, you probably need a couple of headers. Depends on what you want to use. What is the part you want to use for the
K-part stuff?
You need a header that Pythonized, which provides the glue from C++, which actually loads the Python interpreter in the K-part. I can help you with that, probably. Maybe I still have some patches pending for it, which. Samuel has not yet integrated, so just
to show you.
Yeah, sure.
That's small.
Yes, so are there any other questions? So I'll have to give a little demo.
So you talked about general bindings, but what about application bindings? What makes a state for an application to add bindings?
Well,
do they have to do something for one binding? Would be nice to have one. Give an interface to general binding.
That's the advantage of the smoke approach, and it's language independent, so you only have to generate the bindings library once, and then all the other binders, Perl or Ruby or Java, can use the same library. Otherwise, you've got to load the same thing for each of the different languages. So if you had plugins written in Java, Ruby, and Perl, you'd have to load the libraries for all three, which is really expensive, so it should make it possible to have plugins loaded with multiple languages and it can still be efficient.
And what does the developer to create an interface or what?
Well, if we can have a good enough C++ parser, it should be possible just know, have a tool just to generate them, and just like a mock, you don't have to think about it much. As long as the parser's good enough, and all we want to get away from is the approach where you manually fix up everything, and, you know, just have people think that they're like compiling.
Where I'm actually still the case is, what I should do if I want to enable people, say, and there are a couple of custom widgets that are not KDE yet. So I'd like them to be able to use Ruby or Java to write a new plugin that uses both standard QDE and KDE stuff. And the special widgets. I'm very hazy on how I should
I want to
write plugin for creative, say non-filter. They want to use